And as I was saying, you know, you saw a UFO in 1950, and basically you kept your mouth shut. And maybe that's also true if you're a commercial pilot today. But for the rest of us now, we don't need our UFO abduction insurance to protect us against all the mental maligning that we'll encounter. It's a fairly open subject. And there actually is a Center for UFO Studies, CUFOS.org. And Mark Rodiger has been president and scientific director there since 1986. Thanks for joining us, Mark, on WGN Radio.
Hey, good evening, Raleigh. Thanks for the chance to be on and speak with you.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated about this, and I think that most people would agree, other than those who are so hardcore set against this can't possibly be reality. And with that in mind, if this were prior to Roswell, certainly, if people were to talk about this, there might be a lot of people in the room who were dead set against it. At this point in time, how open is the general public to saying, yeah, I've seen a UFO, or I'm aware of them, or, you know, they happen?
As you said just a moment ago, much more so than years ago. You know, when I first got involved in the field, and it was before 86 when I volunteered at the center, and Dr. J. Allen Hynek was still alive and running it, it was much more common to hide your interest, and certainly not reveal the fact that you'd had a sighting with even your family, let alone announce that to the public. But nowadays, yeah, people don't rarely feel ill at ease talking about it, admitting things about it, and yes, even saying that they've had a sighting.
Yeah, it's interesting because you earned a B.S. in astrophysics from IU in 1975, and I can imagine at that time, had this topic been brought up in some of these classes, you would have had professors that were ready to club you for even discussing this.
I actually did, because I by then I had just volunteered at the center, and I managed to get the university through, like, the student union to have Dr. Hynek come down and give a lecture. And that was, you know, you could do that. It was through the student union, not the astrophysics department. But of course, they found out I was like behind that, and that didn't go over too well.
Oh, I'll bet. I would love to see that. Now, more interestingly, after going over to England and studying, you got your MA and PhD from University of Illinois at Chicago in sociology. And, you know, you might on the surface say, well, those are two divergent topics. But when you're talking about UFOs, astrophysics and sociology go hand in hand.
Yes, that's exactly right. I didn't plan that, from the word go, that switch in topics and switch in careers, but it has worked out very well. Because later on in the 90s, I and a couple of other colleagues studied abductees, and we studied the psychology and sociology of them. I've used both areas in my academic background, and you need to do that, and even more so, to fully study the phenomena.
Well, you're the only person I know who actually used his dissertation. Factors influencing attitude toward controversial research, quantitatively disentangling the social from the scientific. That just goes right to the heart of what you do.
Yes, that dissertation was in the, I'm impressed that you actually looked it up and know the title. It's in the sociology of science, and sociologists of science study how science is done, or in my case, how science is not done, because scientists, even today, at least the vast majority of them, still reject the study of the subject. And so while certainly there are many who have, or at least a reasonable number who studied it, and a lot more that have a closeted interest, the mainstream scientific community still feels that the study of the subject is essentially verboten.
Yeah, and laughable, obviously. And the only thing that I know for sure scientifically is that, assuming that they're coming here from God knows where, they're not going the long way, or they'd still be traveling. So what fascinates me is not are they here, how did they get here?
That's generally true, but you know, people have talked now about artificial intelligence and something called the singularity. Mm-hmm. And how someday we'll be able to upload our minds into a combination biological and, you know, technological being or entity.
Mm-hmm.
And so some have theorized, and not just in the UFO community, that aliens could, in fact, use, you know, a combination of a biological and an artificial intelligence to explore the galaxy. And if that's the case, or even just simply robotic machines that are intelligent, then time is less relevant, and you can travel faster than the speed of light and get here from there. But if you are most likely, if you're strictly biological, then yes, it would seem like that hard speed limit just makes it too lengthy to get here.
Well, the long way. And so I would contend that there are shortcuts that we don't understand yet.
That's possible. You know, there are people that have speculated, of course, on wormholes. The Alcubierre Drive is a paper by a fellow with that name who's talked about that if you have almost unbelievable amounts of energy, you can, in fact, travel through a wormhole to somewhere distant in the universe, not just the galaxy. It is certainly true that science has advanced continuously, and what people think at one time is later altered by what people either learned or theorize or discover, you know, another 50 years later. So I think it's quite possible.
Now, it's interesting that we have several people over the last several decades that have come forth with stories of being abductees, some farcical, some not, but I haven't yet found anybody who had a scientific background who had encountered something like this. And by the way, I'm not saying that they haven't. Maybe those are the people who aren't coming forth. But it would be fascinating to hear a story from somebody who understood astrophysics who also had an encounter. Anything like that?
Well, the a couple of things. One of the first abduction cases I looked into was a fellow with a science degree. He was just had graduated from college, but it happened. The first experience he remembered happened when he was driving back from Central Illinois, having visited his girlfriend, and he had what you'd call a classic abduction experience when he pulled his car over to the road, up from the side of the road, really inexplicably, and then they was approached by little beings and taken aboard a UFO. Secondly, Carrie Mullis is a well-known researcher in the area of DNA and all that, and he had, you can read about this experience online, an extremely bizarre experience, maybe more bizarre than aliens, if you can imagine that, because he saw and talked with a raccoon.
Yeah.
And this raccoon, though, he thought was a screen memory. A screen memory of, yes, potentially an abduction.
And this is the fellow who won the Nobel Prize in chemistry?
That is correct. I think it was a Nobel Prize. I shouldn't be quite that quick, but he may have won the Nobel Prize. He certainly is, you know, incredibly honored and a top-notch researcher.
Died about a year ago in Newport Beach.
I think that's the guy.
Yeah, that's our guy. All right.
Yeah.
So, and I know that he briefly had left the science community to write fiction, but even so, talking to a raccoon. All right. Well, you know, that threw me. And so we'll get into that. Why not? In the meantime, I suggest you get into the Center for UFO Studies. You can go to CUFOS.org. I'm Raleigh James. It's WGN Radio. All right. So we are talking about UFOs. And I was just talking with Mark Rodiger, and still am, by the way. And you can join in the conversation anytime. 888-876-5593. 888-88-ROLLYE. And UFOS.org is the website. But we were talking about Carrie Mullis, who died last year. And yes, he did absolutely get a Nobel Prize in chemistry. He also publicly admitted that that some of his insights came from the use of LSD, and in fact helped him develop the polymerase chain reaction that amplifies specific DNA sequences. But he says, no, he was not at all on LSD at the time he had an encounter with, quote, a standard extraterrestrial raccoon. this begs a question, and I'll ask Mark Roniger. A standard, huh? What would be an outstanding raccoon? I mean,
well, the non-standard ones, of course, are usually albino.
Oh, is that it? Oh, well,
yeah, that's the difference, Raleigh.
I had been curious, but it makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah, so. The standard ones look just like a raccoon, except of course those who are experts can see that they're extraterrestrial.
Well, absolutely, and it was in the woods in Northern California around midnight in 1985. And as I say, he's vehemently denied being on psychedelic drugs. Do we have any idea what the raccoon had to say?
You know, I was, I don't recall that, and I don't think that, he himself, I was looking around, as usual on the internet while, you were doing the commercial break there, and I, can't quite find the details. I think it actually, there weren't many, and that is it a typical experience like this, that, you know, he knows it happened, but there was like missing time. There we go. Yes, the raccoon said, "Good evening, doctor." The next, well, what else would you say to a PhD who is a Nobel Prize winner, right?
What else? Yeah.
The next thing I remember, I'm now quoting from his account. It was early in the morning.
Ooh.
I was walking along a road uphill from my house. What went through my head as I walked down toward my house was, "What the hell am I doing here?" I had no memory of the night before. I thought maybe I had passed out and spent the night outside. But nights are damp in the summer in Mendocino, and my clothes were dry and they weren't dirty.
Ooh. Most accounts aren't quite that controversial, but missing time does seem to be a key ingredient, doesn't it?
Yes, and in that sense, his experience is consonant with most experiences of people who say they've had an abduction, like the fellow whose first name was Robert, who I mentioned earlier, who was driving in central Illinois. In fact, he came to the center, and we did a hypnotic sessions with him because he had said that I know something happened to me. In fact, I found what he thought were marks on his body caused by the experience. Even though this was some years later, but it had troubled him. He had had dreams where he thought he remembered fragments of the experience, and he was quite troubled about it. Many people are. Whatever the reason for the experience and the source of it, it does bother them. And so he wanted to, you know, get to the bottom of it, as it were, and see if we could help him discover what did happen.
There have been a few books written about this that detail accounts of actually quite a lot of people over the years. But what I find interesting is now you go to Roswell and the entire town is about UFOs. And this happened in 1947, and they didn't really get actively interested in this till about 1980. So what caused the sudden interest after all those years?
There's a mistaken impression among you know, people, mostly because of television programs and the like, that Roswell was a big deal back in 1947. And it was a big deal for about 4 hours,
right,
until the military squashed the story. And so in the late 1970s, a fellow named Jesse Marcel, who was the intelligence officer at the base, was discovered, as it were, by Stan Friedman, a very well-known UFO investigator who died recently.
Yeah.
And Jesse and Stan met in Louisiana, where he lived. And he told him the story about what had happened in 1947.
Okay.
Stan, go ahead.
I'm going to leave Jesse there, who is a key player, I guess, in promoting, maybe inadvertently, Roswell, and we'll pick it up right there. But, time for the half-hour news. I'm Raleigh James. It's WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James, and we're talking about, well, not so much about extraterrestrial raccoons, but certainly about UFOs. And we got to Jesse Marcel and being interviewed in the late 70s. And our guest, by the way, and this is just a fascinating website, too, I want to mention, but Mark Roniger, and it is CUFOS.org. And it was J. Allen Hynek, Dr. Hynek, who started this, and he's nothing if not fascinating as well, and we'll get to him. But we'll pick up Marcel, and the first question, of course, who found him to interview him in 1978? You know, that was out of the blue.
Yes, Stan Friedman, who did find him, was giving a lecture in the area, and somebody brought Jesse to his attention. Jesse didn't, in fact, seek Stan out. That's important to note. But somebody told him about Jesse, Marcel, and so he called him up, and they talked. And Stan immediately realized, hey, this is important, because here's a guy who, says he was in the military. They had to verify that, but of course he was back in Roswell, and that he had not only learned about a crashed UFO, but he had participated in the recovery of a crashed UFO. So Stan and a couple of colleagues, did some research and investigation, and they wrote a book in 1980. And that's what started the Roswell, almost craze, for which has gone on since then, but really peaked in the 1990s.
Yeah, well, it absolutely made Roswell really a financial success, which they were sort of dying before this. And as far as that goes, they ought to have some type of a monument to Stan Friedman for that alone. But this begs another question. Stan was giving a lecture, so Roswell was on his mind prior to knowing about Jesse.
No, zero on his mind. He was giving his standard Stan Friedman UFO guy lecture.
But, I mean, so was he unaware of Roswell when he was giving the lecture?
Absolutely. I was involved in the field then. All of us were essentially unaware of Roswell.
Fascinating. And boy, did it grow. Like you say, it's a little not quite as prevalent as it was maybe 20 years ago, but still. Now, let's talk about J. Allen Hynek, because he's a very fascinating character to me as far as that goes. And, of course, did his graduate work at the University of Chicago as far as that goes. But he was truly a scientist who, during the war, got a high security clearance. What an interesting thing to have. And I assume that was the start of him maybe getting some insight into what's going on that we were unaware.
Well, it allowed him to be vetted, as it were, beforehand, so that they could use him, the Air Force could use him on their projects. He worked on something called the proximity fuse during World War II. And after that, when he went back to doing astronomy, he was able to participate in high-altitude experiments using V-2 rockets that had been captured from the Germans. So he was always into high-tech and kind of working on the area where you could use the latest technology, in the study of astronomy. But, yes, he had that security clearance, though it had lapsed after the war, but he was a known quantity. He was at Ohio State University then in 1947 and 48, close to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton.
Yeah.
And so his proximity and he was still a young professor, his need for consulting money, to be quite frank, the fact that, yes, people recommended him because of past work, meant that the Air Force reached out to him and said, hey, would you like to help us? And the only thing they asked him to do initially was to look at UFO reports and see if there was an astronomical explanation.
Fascinating. So they initially, at least, weren't trying to quash these stories. They were trying to figure out what might be behind them. So that
yes, one of the really astounding things until lately, with the Navy being so and the government being so relatively open about the UFO subject, is that in the early days, which means the summer of 1947 through late 1948, the military, because that's really who was studying the subject, took UFOs very seriously. They didn't initially think that they were extraterrestrial. Almost no one did, by the way. Polls that were done in that early year or two, the topic of extraterrestrial just garnered a few percent in the polls of the public. It was thought more likely to be something that, if it was real, was going to be something from the Russians or something like that, of some other technological device. So the military took it so seriously that the team at Wright-Patterson, composed of scientists and engineers and military officers, concluded in October or so of 1948 that not only were UFOs real, but that possibly the explanation was extraterrestrial.
And it's interesting because we saw, of course, that was around the time that Kenneth Arnold, a private pilot in Washington State, saw the line of the flying saucers above the Cascades. And then the Air National Guard pilot, I think it was Tom Mantell, crashed a P-51 after chasing some object and, I guess, passing out or something of this. So now you have, at the same time, Roswell, which, like you say, for 4 hours, everybody was fascinated, and then we were told it was a weather balloon. Why do you think that that one, because here they are theoretically embracing it, that one was the big cover-up?
Well, it would have been a cover-up if, in fact, there was a crash and they recovered debris. And I might have covered it up myself back in 1947 if I was in the government, because we wouldn't have known how to respond, how to react. There was no precedent for this. And so if there was a crash, again, it's hardly surprising that the military covered it up. And why would have it had such an effect? Well, you know, that would be it. In fact, there were headlines in the paper because the air base in Roswell announced that they had recovered. They didn't use the word UFO, of course, flying disc. And then higher headquarters essentially countermanded that and said to the press, no, it was a weather balloon. But the whole key to whether or not the government has crashed saucers does go back to that event.
And it's fascinating. And, of course, back to Wright-Patterson a minute, that's where Dr. Hynek was really involved in studying some of the information that was there. And I think he kind of concluded that there's more to this than meets the eye. At that point, the government seemed to go more into hyperdrive of, oh, nothing to see here. So
right. After the report in 1948, which was sent up to higher headquarters and summarily sent back,
that
we cannot conclude, that UFOs are extraterrestrial, the project went into a phase of debunking. And then it was reinvigorated after a massive wave of sightings in 1952, including over Washington, D.C.
Yeah, the assault.
And it stayed very open to the subject for a short while. And then the CIA had a panel in January of 1953 that, among other things, concluded that UFOs were potentially a danger to the military and the government in terms of clogging reporting channels and confusing things so that we would not be able to detect an attack by the Soviets, and that UFOs had to be debunked. And they even talked about using the Disney Company as part of that propaganda effort. And so from 1953 until 1969, when Project Blue Book, that Dr. Hynek was the consultant for, when they closed their doors, Blue Book was essentially a public relations exercise.
And, of course, Dr. Hynek kind of straddled both worlds because he was chair of the astronomy department at Northwestern, not exactly the kind of place you would think that some quote-unquote UFO nut was inhabiting. So, but at the same time, he continued, some very interesting contributions to this. But you mentioned 1969, the closing Project Blue Book. What happens after that?
What happens after that is that the two things, the scientific community concludes because of what actually happened, not just with Blue Book, but something called the Condon Report, or the Colorado Project report that said that the UFOs, there was nothing really here to see, nothing unexplained. So the scientific community could wash their hands of the subject. But with the Air Force out of action, those who were interested, like Dr. Hynek and several others, said, okay, now the field's clear for us to get involved and to be more active, and that did happen. And so in 1973, Dr. Hynek founded our organization.
And it's interesting, in 73, that's also where the kids in Pascagoula, the fishermen, came up with their experience. And I read where Dr. Hynek found himself questioning the very nature of reality. That's fascinating because that's even larger than the study of UFOs. So here he is starting CUFOS, and what differentiates it, so I assume, by the way, it was the first as far as of study, any formal study of UFOs.
Well, there have been UFO groups almost since the word go, but we were really the first scientifically oriented from the word go group. That's correct.
Right, and also from that standpoint, and still around. So based on science rather than, you know, woo-hoo notions of people and their craziness, it's fascinating because the organization has continued, and of course you for decades now are certainly the reason. Now, we talked before about, you can claim you saw a UFO now, which you probably couldn't do in 1950, but other than that, how have things changed?
Boy, that's a big question. Let me start with how the phenomena has changed.
Okay.
So what did people see back then? Well, they saw discs, right, and UFOs. And UFOs landed, and they left traces on the ground. And sometimes when they landed, people saw little humanoid beings or something even weirder by them. Though not typically a raccoon. And so it was that type of thing where daylight sightings occurred and UFOs kind of appeared sometimes very close to people. UFOs were large sometimes, but typically they were more, you know, typical 30 or 50-foot UFO. And then around 1980 or so, the UFO phenomena began to change. And first, people saw larger objects, often triangular and boomerang-shaped. Now, they still see disks, they still see balls of light, but there's a higher percentage of those. Secondly, UFOs started to keep their distance from us. There were fewer landings. There were fewer interactions with people since then. And there were more sightings at night, and that's continued, than during the day. And there were also sightings where they, despite what I've just said about it, they kept their distance and all that, they were almost more visible at times, the famous Hudson Valley sightings north of New York City, where a large triangular UFO was seen by literally thousands of people at one time, or the Tinley Park case here in the southern suburbs of Chicago in 2004, 2005. Where triangular red lights were seen, again, by thousands of people, the first one on a beautiful summer evening in August of 2004. So, you know, because what's most important, what's changed is the phenomenon itself, and those are some of the ways that it's changed. We of course, don't know why, but it is very intriguing, and we can't think of reasons why those things would how the phenomenon has morphed based on something that we're doing, you know, that humanity is doing. We think there's something external that's driving those changes.
Oh, that's fascinating. We're talking to Mark Rodiger. Got any questions? He's got a lot more answers than I do, so call now, 888-876-5593. It's 8888-RALEIGH on WGN Radio. WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James. We'll forego a bumper since we only have a few minutes left with Mark Rodiger from the Center for UFO Studies, and you can check that out, and should, by the way, at CUFOS and .org, by the way. And we were in the middle, and I'll get your calls. Rod in Wisconsin is calling, and so I won't be long-winded on this, but we were in the middle of talking about, okay, more sightings at night, more visible sightings, but not necessarily more interactive. In fact, if anything, less interactive. And the thing that I wonder about, Mark, is whether that there is interest in us because we're hitting a point technologically where we could maybe be a problem.
Possibly. If an advanced civilization, because of their own history and what they've studied possibly in other places, knows that we're close to attaining space travel, then they would be monitoring us closely because of that. And that's been, the most promising hypothesis, you know, not that they're here to save us, but that, in fact, they know that we're near a tipping point in development.
Yeah, I would agree. I never thought they were here to save us. The question is it that or are we breakfast? We've got Rod in Wisconsin. Welcome to WGN Radio.
Yep, thank you again, Raleigh. I called the other night to say my dad was in the Navy World War II. He was in dive bombers, and TBM first and then dive bombers. Anyhow, he said that after missions, the pilots kind of stuck to themselves, but it didn't take long that the word come out, and they had to put a handle on these things, and they called them Foo Fighters.
Yeah.
I don't know if they... F-U or F-O-O,
yeah.
And our neighbors flew night missions with that newer plane. It was a Black Widow, P-61, with the advanced radar. And those were encountering UFOs, unidentified.
Right. Yeah.
So they just came up with Foo Fighters.
Interesting you say that. There is a Nazi Foo Fighter on display, obviously not a real one, a representation, right at the International UFO Museum in Roswell. So if you can, get there and look at it.
Well, yeah, if I ever get there, I doubt I will. But I saw a triangle too, something that I cannot explain. I took dipped my arm, and I told my dad about it, and I took my arm full length in the thumb. So what I did was I said, how big was this thing? And I said, 100 yards, it would have been a half a mile away.
Wow.
And I said, the further away, obviously, more people would have had a chance to see it, obviously. The bigger it was, the further away, you know. And it was a triangle that just kind of came down slowly, never changed speed, three red lights, and it came down about a 20-degree angle, and it just kind of slowly disappeared behind the tree line, you know, and then that halo just kind of slowly dissipated.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no idea what that was. That was 1977 or 78.
And you'll never forget it. Thank you for calling, Rod. We're running out of time, but I appreciate it. And I bet you, Mark, that you get a ton of anecdotal interest like that for folks who want to take part in CUFOS.org. I know you don't take members, but there's a lot at the site. Are you accepting these reports?
We certainly are. We're very happy to do so.
Well, terrific. Well, I think it's wonderful. It's a fascinating study, and hopefully, in at least some of our lifetimes, maybe the younger individuals listening, we'll get to the bottom of this. But good luck, and let us know if anything of great interest should surface.
Thanks for having me on, and I'll do that.
I appreciate it, Mark. Thank you.